Welcome to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, President of the Ohio Christian Alliance. Stay tuned for an analysis and conversation about the issues that matter most to you and your family. Here now with this week's edition of News in Focus is Chris Long.
And good afternoon and welcome to this edition of News in Focus. We're glad that you've joined us. We're going to be talking about the big news that came out of Syria as President Trump announced this weekend that al-Baghdadi, the ISIS leader, had been killed by special forces of the U.S. and Delta Force. And we're going to get to that report in just a minute. A little later in the program, we're going to have with us Claire Lopez. She's from the Center for Security Policy. She's going to be talking about Syria and the Middle East and, of course, this latest development of the war on ISIS, as they, of course, have waged war on religious minorities in the Middle East, targeting Christians, Yazidis, and other Muslim sects. And, of course, they announced their caliphate back in 2014 when the U.S. Stepped down their activity in northern Iraq after the Iraq War. And then, of course, ISIS became literally a terrorist army invading northern Iraq, sacking the city of Mosul and towns and villages in northern Iraq and wreaking havoc through the region for several years until they were beaten back by allied forces. And when President Trump came to office, he announced that he was going to basically take on ISIS. The previous administration initially did not take them seriously, only to find out to their chagrin that it was a very serious threat in the region and, of course, threatened the Kurds, the Yazidis, the Christian minority there in northern Iraq, primarily in Mosul and in other towns and villages in northern Iraq. And, of course, many were killed. Basically, there was a genocide against religious minorities by the ISIS caliphate. But the leader of ISIS has been killed. And here is the report by President Trump this last weekend.
Last night, the United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead. He was the founder and leader of ISIS, the most ruthless and violent terror organization anywhere in the world. The United States has been searching for Baghdadi for many years. Capturing or killing Baghdadi has been the top national security priority of my administration. U.S. Special Operations Forces executed a dangerous and daring nighttime raid in northwestern Syria and accomplished their mission in grand style. The U.S. personnel were incredible. I got to watch much of it. No personnel were lost in the operation, while a large number of Baghdadi's fighters and companions were killed with him. He died after running into a dead-end tunnel, whimpering and crying and screaming all the way. The compound had been cleared by this time, with people either surrendering or being shot and killed. 11 young children were moved out of the house and are uninjured. The only ones remaining were Baghdadi in the tunnel, and he had dragged three of his young children with him. They were led to certain death. He reached the end of the tunnel as our dogs chased him down. He ignited his vest, killing himself and the three children. His body was mutilated by the blast. The tunnel had caved in on it in addition. But test results gave certain immediate and totally positive identification. It was him.
Well, that is a report by President Trump. And, of course, this was great news. For those who have been watching what had been taking place with ISIS as they wreaked havoc in the Middle East and, of course, committed many atrocities against religious minorities in Syria, Iraq, and, of course, over the last number of years. But this was a directive of the president to see this man come to his end, and he's responsible, and those with him, for killing literally tens of thousands in Syria and northern Iraq. And so it's bittersweet because when we think about those who have perished because of the Islamic extremist ISIS, Islamic State, and their caliphate, those who lived in northern Iraq, those Christian minorities in Syria, and it's been a very disappointing and sad reality for the Christians in the Middle East. Here to talk about it with us is a good friend, Joseph Kassab. He is the president of the Iraqi Christian Advocacy and Empowerment Institute. They're centered out of Detroit, Michigan. And, of course, he is in Washington, D.C., and has contacts in Iraq. And he has helped over the years many of his fellow countrymen from Iraq to migrate to the United States to live the liberties that we enjoy in this country. Joe, your thoughts on the news of al-Baghdadi's death on the weekend?
Well, first of all, thank you, Chris, for the invite. I appreciate that. In 2014, I was interviewed by EWTN TV about what is happening and what ISIS is doing now in Iraq, and especially in Mosul or Nineveh Plain. And I explained at that time that if Qaeda was very bad, the ISIS would be much, much, much worse. And they will be attacking everybody, and they are targeting the Christians, they are targeting the Shabak, they are targeting the Yazidis, they are targeting everybody here, including their brothers, the Muslims. So Mr. Arroyo asked me, he said, even the Muslims? I said, yes, even the Muslims, because these guys, if anybody don't go with their backward Sharia law, then he will be targeted. It was hard for him to believe, but it turned out to be exactly right of what I was describing. And now I really, on behalf of my community, would like to thank Mr. President for the good work he's done. He targeted al-Baghdadi, and he went after him. He kept insisting that he will get him, and finally he got him. Now, what I am sad about is I start to hear from some liberal media that they are praising this man, this filthy and dirty terrorist, and praising him in any way they can. That is really bad. But in the meantime, I think it is good for the average Americans to know that, prove to them that this kind of liberal media proved to be biased, and therefore they should not be listening to them or supporting them anymore. But
well,
anyway,
Joe,
going back, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, of course, on this program, News in Focus, we're focusing on what actually occurred, that the al-Baghdadi was killed by Delta Force, Special Forces of the United States,
right,
and with informants from on the ground from the Kurdish folks were able to give us the kind of intel that we needed. And this is a great victory for all those who love religious freedom that did not, like you said, a dirty terrorist. This man and those who followed him were indiscriminate killers of men, women, and children. My God. And yet you have the liberal media in this country, because of their disdain for the president and for conservatives in this country, have flipped this story. And folks, you need to wake up. And really, it is infuriating, Joe, and I apologize. I mean, I've never thought that I'd see our country and the news media literally blow themselves up, figuratively, as far as becoming a reliable news source. I'm talking about CNN. I'm talking about the major media, MSNBC, and all the liberal media of NPR, and turning this story differently, and rather than just reporting what happened, the wicked witch is dead, al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, ladies and gentlemen,
right.
And this is great news, but yet the left is turning the story, and in some regards, and I agree with you, trying to make him out to be some Muslim cleric. Are you kidding me? This is ridiculous. Your thoughts?
Well, As I said earlier, that will make the American people more convinced that this media is playing, a game with them, and they don't have to believe them anymore based on what they are reporting nowadays. So, but going back to the issue of Baghdadi, as you know, Baghdadi was born in Iraq. He was born in a little town called Samarra, and his name is Ibrahim Ali Awad Samarai. He was born in 1971, and he became very attached to his religion. But it looks like that his interpretation to his religion, it got to be much worse than what they are telling him to do. And he himself took the baton in his hand, and he ruled people, and he asked them to join him to fight the non-Muslims, especially the non-Sunni people. And that's exactly what he was doing. And, of course, there was a plan targeted against the Christians in the area, especially in Nineveh Plain. As you know, Nineveh Plain is the size of Lebanon, the country of Lebanon, and is made of more than 100 little villages. Majority of them are Christians. Of course, in the very north of it, there are the Yazidis and some of the Shabaks. And instead of targeting the Christians for some reason, they kind of switched and started to target the Yazidis first. And then after they finished up with the Yazidis, came to the Christians. But by the time they came to the Christians to clean them up, majority of the Christians escaped the area, and they became very displaced and went to northern Iraq, and they stayed with the Kurds, where they were welcomed and taken care of. Now we need to see them going back after ISIS. But the problem is, the ISIS ideology is still there, and is mushrooming very, very fast. So we need to pay attention to that, because if that is the case, we might have the very same dilemma again, and they'll be attacking the helpless, like the Christians and the Yazidis again. So it is important to be careful with that. But in the meantime, those Christians, at the same time, they are facing another kind of ISIS, which is much worse than ISIS now, and that is the Shiite extremist militias called PMF. PMF means the People Mobilizing Units, which are or forces, which are very much well supported by the government of Iraq. And these people are wandering loose in Nineveh Plain and causing all the havoc and the chaos in the area, which does not allow Christians to go back to that particular area, which is the heart of Christianity in Iraq. And that is something we are also worried about, and we need the officials also to add the U.S. administration to pay attention to that.
And we're talking with Joseph Kassab, who's the president of the Iraqi Christian Advocacy Empowerment Institute, centered out of Detroit, Michigan, and advocates on behalf of Christian minorities in the Middle East, and especially the Chaldean Christian community of Iraq. Joe, I'm looking here at a report from the Middle East in Iraq and Syria. It says, rebuilding but not recovering from Islamic extremism. This is from Open Doors. It says, in Iraq, the territorial defeat of ISIS reduced the level of persecution across the country. However, threats from extremist groups make it difficult for returning Christians to feel safe and secure from acts of Christian persecution. In fact, the number of Christians killed during the reporting period slightly increased, and Christians continue to be physically or mentally harmed, threatened, or harassed. This is especially true for Christians from Muslim backgrounds. Explain how persecution is still going on.
Well, not only that, Chris, also there is a very, very dramatic demographic change in the area. And the purpose for that change of demography is to kind of replace the population with the other than Christian people in the area. And that is not acceptable by the Christian and its leadership. We're completely protesting this, and we need to talk to the U.S. administration about this to pay attention to it in order to stop it. Now, all of this is happening with the blessing of the Iraqi government. And we have also that people who are persecuting our people are made up of seven different militias, which they don't work together, but they are very vicious militias. They are very Islamic militias, and militias that they are born in Iran and backed up by Iran. As a matter of fact, the Iranian leaders, the military leaders themselves and their trainers, they go and visit with them the area, the Nineveh Plain area, to decide which one has a which area has the priority first in order to be taken from the Christians.
So, and this, of course, was the concern that we had. These were the Iranian-backed militias that were helping to drive out ISIS, but only to fill the void after the Christians basically had to leave and become refugees in Kurdish territory in Erbil and other places because of ISIS's caliphate in the Nineveh Plain, as you mentioned.
Right.
And so what you're saying is, how many Christians, do we have a number of those who are in the Nineveh Plain in Mosul and the towns and villages? How many have returned?
Well, we don't have a lot returned. I would say no more than 20%, maybe less. The media is exaggerating this. The government is exaggerating this. And some people under the gun from the Christian community leaders, also they are exaggerating the numbers of people coming back. But the reality is, whomever I talk, whomever I know, that they are refusing to return back because they don't feel safe. They see there is nothing, not only for them, but for their children, too, and therefore they don't feel safe at all.
I want to ask is, where are they returning from, Joe? Are they returning from places in Kurdish territory? President Barzani, of course, gave protection to Yazidis, Christians, and other Muslim minorities during the ISIS caliphate, kept refugees safe. Are they returning from those areas or also from outside the country?
Well, let me give your listeners a concept about the Christians, especially the Christians in Iraq. For those who left the country, they were driven out of the country because of the ISIS presence and the persecution and the genocide and all kind of things that took place. These people, normally, they don't go back anymore. For those who are living in the territory inside Iraq, we call them IDPs, internally displaced people. These people, they would like to go back, and some of them did go back, and they did not see it very safe for them to stay there because of the presence of the Islamic Shia militias, as I described. So, therefore, a lot of them are now staying in Kurdistan, waiting for something to happen in order to cleanse the area from the militia, Iraqi Islamic militias, which are Iranian-backed militias. If that happens, then they can go back. But it doesn't seem to me it will go back. We have prepared a lot of restabilization programs for the area. Believe it or not, we ourselves here in the U.S. were unable to execute these programs in the areas that where our people were evicted from. And we are unable to do that because they do not allow us in. There is too much of a presence of these militias, and they conquered the whole area. So it's not easy for everybody to work there. Now, some of them who are under the control of the Peshmerga people, they are going back and they have some living there. But there are always clashes between the Peshmerga and the militias, the PMF, the Popular Mobilization Forces, which are the Shia forces. This is causing a trouble. And people cannot live in peace and prosperity there at this time, not at all. But we have devised a lot of programs for them to go back, but we just cannot execute.
We will be praying for them, Joe. And let me ask this well, because I know that ISIS basically had a scorched earth policy. They weren't leaving Mosul easily when forces came in. And, of course, the city was the victim of course, a conflict with war. What is the status of the infrastructure and the buildings? What were people returning to, in other words? What does Mosul look like?
Well, I asked questions, and I myself, about 3 years ago, went and visited the area from distance, and I saw what I saw. It's completely leveled with the ground, to be honest with you. One side of Mosul, there is no way you can live there. It requires 100% reconstruction and renovation. The other side, it's half of that. And it still does not help a lot of people to go back and live there. Not only that, but also the services there are not very available. And we have a corrupted government in Iraq and in Mosul, of course. And this government, majority of the money, they keep it for themselves and they give it for their clients. And there's nothing done so far. So we are very, very upset with the whole situation. But here's something that we saw some light at the end of the tunnel. The vice president office himself and Vice President Pence himself, God bless him, he decided to help through the USAID and under, of course, the auspices of the U.S. administration. And they are doing what they can do to bring in back people to kind of repair what they can repair. But it is the whole work, no matter how much money we spend there, it's in its infancy, number one. Number two, our people are so scared, and they have learned their lesson that they don't want to go back there anymore. So majority of them are not going back. Yes, few of them did go back because they ran out of money or because of they were not very happy where they were. And therefore, they want to go back no matter what. But what's there to go for? There's nothing for their children. There's nothing for them. There are no jobs. They're all taken by the we call them Hashd al-Sha'bi, which is the PMF. And they're controlling the whole area. The Islamic flags are everywhere in Nineveh Plain. Even on schools and in the churches and schools, they have been renamed to Iranian cleric names, like Al-Khomeini School. This is, for God's sake, and Nineveh Plain area, which is all Christians and some of the Yazidis. You put a Khomeini School in the area, you change the name? So there is a demographic changes taking place, and that is very, very dangerous for the whole area.
We're talking with Joseph Kassabi, is the president of the Iraqi Christian Advocacy and Empowerment Institute, centered out of Detroit, Michigan. Joe himself was born in Iraq and had to leave some years ago because of persecution as a Chaldean Christian Catholic. Over the years, he has been able to help to migrate a number of his countrymen to the United States. What is that process right now for visa applications of those who want to leave and come to the United States or come to Western countries? How is that progressing, Joe?
Well, at this time, it looks like it is not going very well. It is almost on hold at this time. But we are appealing to the U.S. administration to activate what we have started before, because the Christians and the other persecuted people, they deserve to be resettled if they don't want to go back home. And that is something that is very humanitarian to do. And we certainly know that the president himself, he decided to admit about 4,000 Iraqis from Iraq. Majority of them, they're going to be Christians. I don't know when this process will start, but when it starts, we would like to see it start and work quickly, because these people are living in shambles and in a very chaotic situation. And
okay, Joe, we've run out of time. Thank you for being my guest today. We will be praying for the community. Again, Joe Kassab with the Iraqi Christian Advocacy Organization. Look them up online. We'll have a link on our website. God bless you, my friend. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Thank you very much.
Who's looking out for seniors today? It's not the AARP. AARP worked overtime to help pass Obamacare, the legislation that cut over $700 billion from Medicare. And AARP supports the death tax, which can rob families of over half their savings due to the death of a loved one. Seniors know that AARP would rather make millions peddling insurance products than support the policies that actually help America's elderly. That's why America's seniors count on the 60 Plus Association. For more than 20 years, 60 Plus has been fighting for the seniors that AARP has left behind. 60 Plus fought against Obamacare and continues to fight every day for its repeal in Washington. And 60 Plus is the leading national organization working to repeal the death tax once and for all, so that families can pass down their businesses and farms to the next generation, not the IRS. Stand up for your values. Join 60 Plus today. Visit 60plus.org or call 703-807-2070. This message paid for and authorized by the 60 Plus Association.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity.
And the soldiers who stormed the beaches of Normandy and the Allied liberation of Europe. On D-Day, all those warriors set out on their mission. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt led our nation in prayer.
The D-Day Prayer Project is an effort to add FDR's D-Day prayer in its entirety at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. This wonderful historical presidential prayer will be a lasting tribute to our World War II veterans. If you'd like to make a contribution towards the effort of adding this prayer to the memorial, go to the website at ddayprayerproject.org. That's ddayprayerproject.org.
Okay, and we're back, and we're continuing to talk about, of course, the events over the weekend with the killing of El-Baghdadi. The president announced on the weekend the ISIS leader that had been target number one for several years by the president and by U.S. forces. And, of course, we just had on with us Joseph Kasaba, the Iraqi Christian Advocacy Organization. Please look them up online. Support their cause and pray for the Christian people of Iraq. With me on the phone right now is Claire Lopez. She is Vice President for Research and Analysis with the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C. That's also the organization that Frank Gaffney, who's a guest on this program in the past, is part of and founder of. And Claire, this has been breaking news this week, of course, in the Middle East. And I want to get into the intricacies because I know that this is really one of your areas of expertise, and Syria specifically, which actually many people criticize the president for his drawback of U.S. forces initially, but then comes this big news of the kill, we're going to say capture, but it was actually the kill of the ISIS leader. One military analyst also said that maybe laptops and intel was taken during the raid as well. What do you know on that front?
Well, it's a very important development that U.S. Special Forces, who'd been working on this case, by the way, for many, many months, were able to move in on Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's hiding place, which was in the province of Idlib, not very far from the Turkish border with what used to be called Syria, resulted not only in his death, by the way, interestingly, by suicide, with a suicide vest, which, of course, is a straight go to hell, do not pass, go, do not collect $200 under Islamic law, committed suicide. A number of his close working operatives from the Islamic State also were killed in a gun battle with the U.S. Special Forces, Special Operations Forces. So he is no more, and that is a very good and welcoming development. It is, I think, very interesting that the Kurds, whom we there's no other word for it, we stabbed them in the back, we betrayed them with what we did in northern Syria, pulling out and leaving them to the slaughter of the Turkish forces and their jihadi allies. Those Kurds of the Syrian Democratic Forces were the ones who worked so closely, not just previously with United States forces in going after the Islamic State, but in this operation as well to take down Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. So a very important development. But we have to be careful, I think, about too much optimism looking forward. You know, the king is dead, long live the king. Well, Baghdadi is dead. His successor will soon take his place. Jihad continues.
Well, it is an important moment because those who have been watching and on this program, we've chronicled the emergence of the ISIS army originally in 2014 and its invasion into northern Iraq in August of that year. Of course, sacking the city of Mosul in northern Iraq, taking the weapons stash that the U.S. forces left behind, everything excluding M1 tanks. They were actually had our top-notch artillery, field artillery piece, because the Iraqi army basically left it to them as they evacuated Mosul when ISIS was coming in. And, of course, then the caliphate was announced and the Christian minority, the Yazidis and Muslim minorities, along with the Kurds, became the targets of the ISIS army during the Obama years. And on this program, we've had members of the Chaldean Christian community basically give us reports of those who were basically refugees now in Kurdish territory. And we chronicled that through the years. So this is a major development, because this man, of course, was the espoused leader of ISIS, and then to see his demise and President Trump announcing that is a great victory. And I mean, obviously, it's bittersweet because we think of the atrocities on Christians and religious minorities, the butchering of men, women, and children, the abduction and rape of many women and held captive, and just all of what ISIS was about. In their extreme brutality, to see this dirty terrorist, as our previous guest said, come to his demise is a great moment we want to relish while we can. Especially, Claire, I haven't been flipping through the dials myself, except for reading on the internet some of the ludicrous covering of this report from the liberal media in our country. I mean, I had to apologize to our previous guest, Joe Kassab. This is something of which his people, his own flesh and blood, were victims at the hands of this man and those in his army and in their cult. And yet the liberal media in this country, because of their hatred towards our president and the conservative right, it's unbelievable the kind of reporting we're seeing on the left. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it's very important to understand a couple of things. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, first of all, took that nom de guerre, and it's not his birth name, right? It's the name he took, Abu Bakr. Why? Because he styled himself after the first Abu Bakr, who was the first caliph after Muhammad. And what did that first caliph do? What was his job? He was the first great Islamic reformer. Why? Because after Muhammad is said to have died in 632, the tribes of the Arabian Peninsula thought, the old man's dead, we can go do what we want, and they slipped away. Abu Bakr's job was to round them all up, apostates and heretics, and force them back under the black flag under what's called the Ridda Wars, the Wars of Apostasy. Well, that's why Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi took the name, because he, too, was an Islamic reformer whose intent was to purify Islam back to the roots of the time of Muhammad, the pure, true roots of the Quran, the Sunnah, the Sharia. The one other great Islamic reformer that I would name, of course, would be Ibn Wahhab of the 18th century in Arabia, from which we get Wahhabism. Reform does not mean turn Islam into something it's never been and never will be. It means go back to the roots. Return to the foundations. That's what Abu Bakr did. And he did it not so much as a fighter. He did it as an Islamic scholar. He had a PhD in Islamic studies. He knew Islamic doctrine, law, and scripture. And everything the Islamic State did was scrupulously sourced to Islamic doctrine. That's what people have to understand. And that is why whoever succeeds him, and somebody will, likewise will cue closely to Islamic doctrine as they try to reestablish a caliphate, which is obligatory for every Muslim on the face of the earth to attempt to do.
We're talking with Claire Lopez, and she is with the Center for Security Policy. Claire, as we look at Syria, and of course the president's initial announcement of the drawback of U.S. forces, and we're talking basically, first of all, we don't have a congressional authority to be in the borders of Syria. The idea there was, of course, to take on ISIS. It is a region that has been in conflict and for many years, in hundreds of years. Quite honestly, the Syrians, the Turks, the Kurds, Christian minority, all inhabit that area. It is a triangle of confusion, quite honestly, of that area. And then, of course, with the Syrian civil war, that's where all these this quagmire basically began, and then ISIS filling the void, and also in northern Iraq. But the president, you know, and again, I would have to be those who would support the president's decision to draw back. And I want to make a distinction here, because you talked about the Kurds. The Kurds, and this is, they do a general description of the Kurds. There's a difference. There's like seven different Kurdish groups. I mean, there's Kurds in Turkey. There's Kurds in Iran. There's Kurds in Iraq and in Syria. The Kurdish people have no border country themselves. After World War I, the powers that be did not carve out a landmass for the Kurds. They're a people group without an actual territory. And that's where some of these problems exist because of that. And so we have relationship with Erbil and the Peshmerga and those who in northern Iraq who we have been allies with us in the Iraq War. This Kurdish group actually had contact with what we consider the terrorist wing of the Kurdish group that was in Turkey. And then you have the complication that Turkey is a NATO ally. And until that changes, we do have treaty-bound obligations to a treaty ally of NATO rather than, you know, other forces on the ground. And I know you used some very strong language saying about that we betrayed these Kurds. But quite honestly, they have been given an opportunity to take some positions as well, but they refused to leave the area themselves. And so they were using us, quite honestly, as a bargaining chip to take that territory. And it gets complicated, I know. But, you know, that's where the president was saying, well, wait a second. We have basically special forces here. We're going to draw back to some bases. We'll conduct operations when needed. And we're not going to put our people as a placeholder in here among these forces, which, of course, is Iran and has interest in the region with Syria. And then, of course, Russia. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, I'll key in on two words. One is perceptions, and the other one is void. Perceptions in this part of the world, the heartland, if you will, of the Middle East, matter a whole lot. And the perception is growing in the region among friend and foe alike, that this president, whom I support strongly, but that this president does not back up his words with action. He has allowed Iran to run amok, to attack Saudi Arabia, to attack global, I mean, oil facilities upon which the entire world depends, allowed Iran to bring down one of our drones, allowed Iran and its proxies to surround not just our number one key ally in the region, Israel, but also now the Arabian Peninsula, attack shipping at sea with no response. Perceptions really matter a lot. And so I would argue that the United States does have core compelling national security interests in the region. I just alluded to a few of them. Freedom of the seas, freedom of passage of the waterways, especially the most important straits, Hormuz, Bab el-Mandeb, Suez Canal, and then, of course, the southeastern littoral of the Mediterranean Sea itself. Standing by Israel, which holds the line in that region against the Islamic Jihad movement of the Middle East that has invaded Europe how many times in the past. Israel stands between that and what is ever left of Christendom. And then the other word that I wanted to talk about was void. And so when we pull back forces, which bang for the buck, those forces were they were really accomplishing a great deal with a very small number of troops. What were they doing? They were they were showing the U.S. flag, showing our determination, showing our resolve to be in this area and to defend our interests, which include many bases, facilities, diplomatic, military, and otherwise. Number two, those forces blocked the land, overland Shia Crescent, some people call it, or land bridge, land corridor, of the jihadist regime of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Mediterranean coast. They blocked that. They blocked the acquisition by Iran and its proxies of the oil fields in Deir ez-Zor, for example. And they stood by our partners and allies, the Kurds, who had fought and died by the thousands against the Islamic State. We lost, what, every life is valuable, but fewer than 10. And then we pulled out. The region looks at that as it, from the perspective of strong horse, weak horse. Strong horse is the one like Israel that never, ever lets a single attack go by without an immediate, forceful response. U.S. hasn't done that.
Well, again, Claire, I would have to say, though, but we do not have mission directive there by Congress to be in Syria.
Well, then let's get Congress.
All that may be true, what you're saying, but we do not have mission directive from Congress. So the president's saying, without that, we don't even have a U.N. resolution to be there, as we had been in the region earlier. And there are people who have a differing opinion and saying, we can't be policemen everywhere around the world. It is a very complicated area. There's a lot of vying interest, and we just can't continue to do this. I don't need to tell you the view of Rand Paul, for instance. And so, you know, he supports the president's position on this. And, you know, and again, at this point, and I'm not fully of the view of Rand Paul, but neither am I of the view that we should be, you know, because basically we've had members of our family that have fought in Iraq. The president wasn't a supporter of the war in Iraq. You just got off the phone with Iraqi Christian advocacy Joe Kassab talking about the plight of Christians in Iraq. We're going to have to advocate for them in another way. And Iranians are, through militia groups, doing a demographic change of where the Christians no longer inhabit northern Iraq. They're coming in and they're taking over the area. That is a problem.
It's not just Iran and its proxies. Look at what's going to happen now. We go back to the word void. Who moves into the void that the United States just vacated? Russia. Putin's Russia moves in. The genocidal ruler of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, moves in. And who else? The neo-Ottoman jihad regime of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey moves in, occupies territory, and it will not be giving up that territory. For at least the last 2 years, Erdogan and his top officials have repeatedly been talking about jihad, 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 the Kurds are first. No more did Hitler stop with the Sudetenland than Erdogan is going to stop with the Kurds.
Well, we have forces in the area, in bases in northern Iraq, and we've told Erdogan, who is an ally through NATO treaty, basically the president was leveraging with sanctions on Turkey, a NATO state, saying that to stop the offensive in northern Syria. He did that.
Yes, he wagged his finger at them, and what happened? They occupied the territory. The Turks used jihadist allied militias to conduct ethnic cleansing of the Kurds in the region, and they intend to repopulate that region now with whom? With pro-Muslim Brotherhood Sunni refugees that had fled Syria earlier in the warfare. They're going and have been cared for, taken care for inside of Turkey.
Well, I understand that the Center for Security Policy is advocating that we push Turkey out of NATO?
I speak for myself only.
I'm just saying. Is there an effort to do that? To actually push them out of the NATO treaty? Because that's what you're talking about. Because then you're talking about taking on a conflict with a NATO ally.
At the Center for Security Policy, 1 year ago, we published a book which can be found at our website, but also at Amazon.com, and it's called Ally No More. We published that in 2018. Ally No More. Now, when the NATO treaty was first established, there were no provisions in it for downgrading a member or sidelining a member or ejecting a member. That it was
right.
never conceived of that would be necessary. So there are no such provisions. But I think sooner or later, and I'd rather sooner, we, the rest of us in NATO, have to understand that Turkey is no longer a NATO ally, and we must decide how to handle that situation. It is a neo-Ottoman jihadist regime bent on expansion by jihad. And I didn't say that. Erdogan says that.
We're talking with Claire Lopez. She is with the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C. Claire, as we look at the current leadership, Erdogan, in Turkey, if there was to be a change in leadership that would be more friendly to the West and maybe against Islamic extremism, you're saying that Turkey currently is trending towards more of an Islamic extremist position. Is that your position?
Well, no, I would never use the word extremism. I think that's not an accurate term to use. I would say that Erdogan is more of a faithful, devout, practicing Muslim than his predecessors, let's say, during the 20th century, when Turkey's government, at least, was on a pathway set by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, after World War I, which is a pathway of modernization and secularization, at least at the governmental level. But with Erdogan, that is now all out the window. And it is not because he's extremist, it's because he's faithful. He's faithful to the commandments of Islam. He intends to enforce the commandments of his faith. That's not extremist. That's mainstream, normative, orthodox, straight up the middle Islam.
So as we look at the Christian minority in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria, what reports are you getting pertaining to the Christian minority in Syria, for instance? Because, obviously in Iraq, persecution of Christians actually continues. There's actually an upheaval in Iraq. In Baghdad, there are protests currently against the central government by all takers, basically, not just Christians, but Muslims as well, who are upset with the status quo in Baghdad. But what do you perceive as the future for the Christian church in Syria going forward?
Well,
Because, oddly enough, the Syrian central government was actually protecting Christians.
This is what I was going to say. That actually, under Bashar al-Assad, who's a kind of he's a splinter from Shiite Islam of the Alawite minority there. He more or less protected Christians. I mean, until the civil war broke out, and then everybody was targeted and attacked. But now with Turkey moving in, with Iran moving in, with Iran's proxies moving in, there's no guarantee for anybody, Christian, Yazidi, Muslim, Sunni, Muslim, Shiite, or anybody else, unless you are allied with the power that now will be feasting on the carcass of what used to be called Syria. Unless you're allied with the local power in that area, you've got no protection, which is why militias arise in the first place, actually.
Iran currently, obviously, is disabled economically. The sanctions are having a terrible impact upon the people of Iran, and because of the extreme government, what do you see going forward as far as policy with Iran and the United States?
Well, the sanctions have been devastating that the United States under President Trump renewed against the Iranian regime after he took the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, back in May 2018. But the bottom line is that while the people of Iran are suffering terribly, the regime is not really suffering all that badly. And in fact, those who are in power, and I would say, take a look at this, watch this. It is the guns, it is the thugs who hold power in Iran. IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Quds Force, the Basij, the Intelligence Service, the MOIS, Ministry of Intelligence and Security. Not only or not just the mullahs, and maybe not even just the ayatollahs. And so those who have the power of the doorway, who control what goes in, what goes out, what actually does get imported or exported, they're making money hand over fist. They're becoming richer and richer. So I think that sanctions alone will not be sufficient. I think that eventually either the regime will simply survive or else other action will have to be taken if that regime is to be gone and the people of Iran to be able to stand on their own two feet for their own liberty.
Something we'll have to be watching. Claire, thanks for being my guest a bit today. So much appreciate
Thank
all
you.
The pertinent information. Again, centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Please visit them. Thank you for listening today, and God bless.
You have been listening to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. To learn more about the issues that matter most to you and your family, visit online at ohioca.org. That's ohioca.org. Thank you for listening. This program is sponsored by the Ohio Christian Alliance of Akron, Ohio.